All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah Qualhorst, and I'm a PhD student in the Department of Entomology at Kansas State University. And today, I just wanted to share my personal journey into the wonderful world of insects with you all and why we should care about these small creatures. So when I was a young girl, I dreamed of being a scientist. Though I wasn't exactly sure which kind I really wanted to be, it all began through curiosity about our everyday world, like a flame lit by the amazing animals drawn by Maria Marion, like in our story for all ages today, and in other books that I read during my formative years at the library. So I checked out a lot of different stories about creatures, big and small. I even checked out field guides and encyclopedias just so that I could look at the different pictures of all the colorfully illustrated animals. And when I got a little bit older, I went to a science camp 2 years in a row in fifth and sixth grade, intended for female scientists of the future. And by seventh grade, I was telling everyone I knew I wanted to be a meteorologist, like the ones on TV, or a weather woman. But I do remember a turning point in my path. I had always been interested in insects as well, and other bugs. I collected them, I raised them to adulthood, I studied them, and I even tried once to write a short story about a giant garden spider that had taken up residence by my front door. However, when I was young, I never really quite understood their full significance in my life, or how they shape our society. They were just simply my hobby. And I remember specifically my grandmother at the time kept telling me I needed to read a particular book, which she read when she was a little girl, entitled A Girl of the Limberlost by Jean Stratton Porter. And as kids do, I kept putting it off while questioning the necessity to even read it. But one day, she actually gave me her book, which was the first edition copy of the book, and told me I could keep it. It was really well worn and torn, but it seemed like a precious thing to give up, especially because it had provided her with such a rich experience. So obviously, I decided I had no reason to avoid it, and I was going to read it. The story actually takes place in my home state of Indiana, near the Limberlost Swamp. And this is an actual place. It still exists today to some extent, but it was seriously logged and drained beginning around the time of the novel, which is in the 1920s. So the novel's main character is Elnora Comstock, and she was an impoverished young woman who lived with her widowed mother. She had a really difficult relationship with her mother due to the death of her father and was not encouraged to pursue an education. However, Elnora was particularly determined that she was going to pursue an education, and she found a way to sell these really giant silk moths that she caught as she walked through the Limberlost Swamp. She was able to sell them and make money to attend school. So I was really inspired by Elnora's determination, and even more by the exciting insects that she mentioned in her story, especially those large silk moths, because they're one of my favorite insects, which was the focus of this book. So this was another kind of puzzle piece, but I still wasn't quite sure how this fit into my path yet. So now it was the summer of eighth grade, and one of my friends had convinced me that I needed to come to the 4-H Project Fair and look for a project that year. And I had actually never been involved in 4-H before, but I was really hopeful and excited to find a new project. So I browsed the different projects that were being advertised, and I was looking for something that would catch my interest. And suddenly I stopped at a table with boxes of curated insects. And I was completely enthralled. The minute I saw those insects, I immediately knew that was the project for me. I didn't want to do any other project in 4-H. And for anyone not familiar with 4-H entomology projects, basically students will collect 10 insects each year, curating them to build a total of 100 specimens by the time you graduate for the final year of the project, which ends usually around 12th grade in high school. In addition, there's also the opportunity to do do-it-yourself experiments. So you're required to complete activities in a book that they provide on investigations of insects and their different behaviors. And then students ultimately compete in their counties with their insect collections, and if their collection is the best, they're selected to go on to the state fair for that state and compete there as well. So this collection really allowed me to dive deeper into the world from the perspective of these small creatures that run it. And each species for me had a new story to reveal that I could observe unfolding before my very eyes as I took adventures around the landscape searching for these insects for my collection. So I was truly in my element. And one year, my project leader, who was a retired entomologist, turned to me one day and said, "You know, you can do this for a living, right?" So I had no reason to doubt the truth that he told me. I believed him right away, and from that moment on, I knew I was going to be an entomologist. So of course, I have since learned that the frequent joke that's said is an entomologist is a biologist that gets paid. So there were many events which culminated for me on that day and changed my course. I had kind of been heading this path all along. On a deep level, a part of me always knew, like I said, I wanted to be a scientist. And so now, finally, I discovered my place in science. So I stand before you today. I'm an entomologist, and I'm pursuing my PhD, which is really amazing that I actually stuck to what I said I'd do in about ninth grade, and here I am. So through my subsequent degrees, undergraduate and master's program, insects have truly inspired my life and have brought me a sense of awe and wonder along the way. So it's taken me years to appreciate their full influence on me as well as everyone else's life. But there are over 900,000 insect species described by science, and that's about 80% of all the world's species. And this is just a small drop in the bucket compared to the estimated 2 million to 30 million species of insects on the planet that aren't even described yet. So they are both our worst enemy as well as our best friend, and they're main competitors for our food as well as our greatest help in producing it. So I just want to cover now a few of the ways that they intimately influence our lives. For example, insects, as we've just heard a bit about the mosquito and the hymn, have killed more humans than other humans have killed in all the world's wars combined. So just let that significance sink in for just a second. So if you put World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the French Revolution, the Civil War, all of the human conflicts going back to the ancients on one side, and then place the lowly mosquito on the other, they have killed more by spreading malaria, dengue fever, yellow fever, and other diseases. These mosquito spread diseases have so impacted human evolution that in areas where malaria is endemic, there is actually multiple fold higher incidence of the sickle cell anemia, where blood cells become deformed, but it also provides partial protection against infection by malaria parasites. So in an interesting twist to the story, male mosquitoes are actually harmless. It's only the females that require blood meal to help the eggs mature. And in fact, the male mosquitoes actually serve as pollinators. Something very few of us appreciate nowadays is that malaria actually used to be endemic and widespread in the United States as well, and was transmitted from person to person in the Great Plains, Great Lakes states, and up into New England. So as recently as the 1930s, malaria was still commonly found throughout the southern United States. So massive eradication campaigns took place, and basically with insecticides, our generation luckily stopped the spread of malaria infection in the U.S. However, there is actually no guarantee that that will remain so, as we have other tropical diseases coming up all the time, like Zika, and they're always going to be a threat to us. Also, we're still at risk of other diseases here, like tick-borne diseases. Every time we go on a jaunt in the Flint Hills, the risk of arthropod diseases is, in fact, just a part of living as humans on this planet. Beyond disease, though, insects eat our dwellings, think about termites, and can also decimate our forests and ornamental plants in our yard. Think about the gypsy moth or the emerald ash borer. I'm sure most of us have heard that name mentioned. They can be uncomfortable invaders in our homes, Think about stink bugs or clover mites that are a problem in the fall and spring, as well as traumatic housemates like bed bugs, which might be feeding on you at night and are really hard to get rid of, or even kissing bugs. But while some of these arthropods may be dangerous or a nuisance, others are downright fascinating. So we've talked a bit about ants in the video, but let's take the case of ants. Most of us just think they're either red or black ants, but in fact, there are over 13,000 different species of ants. And if you gather up all these ants, as we've heard in the video, and put them on one side of a scale, and take all 7 billion humans and put them on the other side, we weigh about the same. So that translates to 15 quadrillion ants per person. That's the number 15 with 15 zeros after it. Besides being the most numerically dominant life form in our landscape, ants also have some really cool adaptations. So if you think about desert species of ants, for example, they're more wisely when they decide whether or not they're going to go to war with neighboring colonies of ants. So these ants will line up in a single file line in the colony, with each ant from each colony counting the number of ants in either side. And basically, if there are more numbers on the opposing side, they may retreat and decide not to attack. But if they think there's roughly equal numbers, they may decide to stay and fight. So further, leafcutter ants were actually the first farmers on our planet. They beat us humans to the punch by about 65 million years. Ants were also the first cattle herders on our planet as well, as they round up aphids and milk them for honeydew. So they've kind of mastered animal husbandry as well 50 million years before us. A desert species of ant has a better sense of direction than most of us humans. They're able to spend hours foraging, taking winding paths, but they're still able to make a quick beeline back to their nest, regardless of what path they took winding looking for food. Also, ants are really strong. They can lift up to 50 times their weight, which would be like the average human being able to lift 3.5 tons, like it's simply nothing. And ants dig their nests so deep and wide that it's fundamental for cycling nutrients and cleaning up waste in our ecosystems. If you were to simply pour molten metal or some plaster casting down into an ant nest, the depth and complexity of that structure you might find after you pull it up would simply surprise you. Regularly as tall as a human and wider than one, too. So there is an example of an ant nest that, again, someone poured something down into, and that's how deep it was and how complex. So these achievements wrought by evolution over barely imaginable time scales quickly begin to boggle our minds. But for me personally, studying insects is a way to help the world by reducing and ultimately ending world hunger. That's my passion. So I tend to focus on ways to more sustainably and effectively manage stored products, insect pests specifically. Now, stored products, insect pests, are any insect that attacks and destroys our food after harvest. This could be grain, cereal, meals and flours, and really any other dried goods that you may have stored in your kitchen pantries. So these insects take away a third of that food before it even reaches our table. And in developing countries, these losses reach up to 3/4 of the food, 75%, before it makes it to the human mouth. So the United Nations has estimated that if we are to feed our world population, which is increasing rapidly, we will need to increase agricultural production by that same amount. So I'm personally trying to make sure that we increase the efficiency of our world's food supply by stopping these post-harvest losses. If we can address the large losses after harvest and reduce them, then we can hopefully help leave the world in better shape for those who come after us. But what about all the insects that don't really seem to harm us at all? There are a lot of those too. Not every insect has a negative impact on us humans, our property, and our animals and pets. Let's think back to those giant silk moths of the Limberlost Swamp that I mentioned before in the book. So here you can see a large Cecropia moth. which is definitely one of the beautiful silk moths. Their striking beauty as adults is simply mesmerizing. And this is only one example. There are definitely more colorful silk moths out there. They complete their life cycle without harming us or our property. Their immature larvae serve as food sources for many other animals, birds, and insects, and they don't really cause a significant amount of damage to our trees or plants. They sometimes lay up to 400 eggs in the hopes that even just 10 will make it to adulthood and continue the cycle. Because there are so many things that prey on them, they have to lay that many eggs. So the adult moths like this one do not actually feed, and they don't have mouth parts. So they simply serve to reproduce again and start the cycle over. When these giant and gentle creatures flutter in, if you've ever seen them, they're like a bird of the night, and they come quickly to our house lights, fluttering and finally taking rest near light sources. For me, silk moths are a welcomed encounter in my daily life. Similarly, insects have also inspired human societies for generations, reaching all the way back to the ancients. In ancient Egypt, scarab beetles were a symbol of immortality, resurrection, transformation, and protection, and they were actually commonly used in artwork for funerals. So, shiny and flashy insects have inspired art over millennia, including up to the present day, with necklaces that incorporate beetle elytra from the emerald ash borer. I think we have an image. So these are beautiful elytra from a beetle that has caused so much damage to us, but it makes beautiful art. Also, butterfly collectors have been as pervasive as bird watchers. So many people collect butterflies. And of course, who could forget the valued honeybee? Most of us have heard of pollinators and honeybees and the valuable work that they're doing to help us on this planet by pollinating our plants, especially our food plants. In fact, one out of every third bite of food that you take comes from an insect-pollinated crop. And a world without bees would certainly be one where most of the interesting foods that we love would be missing from our tables. I think we have a picture. So we'd be missing all these great things on this slide. However, what most people don't actually know is that 60% of the pollination of our crops is actually performed by wild solitary bees. So not the iconic honeybees that we're all familiar with. There are these bees that we need to worry about and try to protect because they do not live in these massive colonies protected by humans. They're spread out across the landscape, and they need these diversified landscapes to be able to survive. Some burrow in the ground, and others dig into wood for their homes, and their populations are more sensitive to stress than bumblebees or honeybees. In fact, honeybees aren't even native to North America, so it may be more productive to think of them as imported livestock from Europe. Many native bees are more efficient pollinators, and they pollinate a wide variety of our plants, more so than the honeybees. But while most of us think of a pollinator when we think of beneficial insects, what about predators that help by eating those bad insects for us, such as dragonflies? Dragonflies may often be overlooked, but they actually play an important role in reducing mosquitoes and other biting flies around us and around our homes and other living spaces. So dragonfly adults are the predators, but so are the larvae. They swim around lakes and streams. They eat maggots of horseflies, black flies, and other vermin. And dragonflies serve not only as predators, but they're also food for birds, frogs, and other creatures. So they play an essential role in these functioning aquatic habitats. As is most often the case, truth is stranger than fiction. So too is the case with beneficial parasitoids. Little creepy, but there are small wasps, one that would never even bother us humans, and they may not be bigger than the size of a freckle on our arms. They will seek out caterpillars and lay eggs just inside the caterpillar. And when that egg hatches out, the baby wasp will eat the caterpillar from the inside out. It then pupates into an adult and emerges from the husk of the caterpillar, intent on seeking out another caterpillar to continue the cycle. So for those of us who've seen the movie Aliens, a similar sort of thing is happening. As horrifying as it may sound to all of us, these are an enormous help to us as we grow our crops, because many of these tiny parasitoids are attacking pests that actually are eating our food. So it gets even more incredible now, because for every insect species that feeds on plants, there are 3 to 9 other species of tiny wasps that will attack it in the same manner. Now, even more absurd is the fact that there are tiny wasps that only attack the developing tiny wasps that attack those caterpillars. So these are known as hyperparasitoids. Basically, it's a parasitoid that attacks a parasitoid. So if parasitoids were beneficial to humans, these hyperparasitoids are not our friends, because they're targeting the little wasps that kill our pests. Now imagine that you also have a parasitoid that only attack parasitoids of caterpillars. I could go on and on, because as I said, there are always some other species attacking a species that attacks another species. So needless to say, the intricateness with which ecological relationships have been weaved is incredibly awe-inspiring. Even if they're a little creepy or gross, we have to respect their amazing ability. So in terms of life history, insects can likewise be extreme. Some insects, such as aphids, are literally just clones of each other. So an aphid foundress will start a colony, give birth, live birth to her clones, and her clones will give birth to more clones. So sometimes aphids being born are already pregnant with their own offspring, meaning that in one swoop you have the grandmother, the mother, and the daughter all occupying the same space. In humans, if you have a Y chromosome, you would be considered male, and if you have 2 X chromosomes, you would be considered female. But in some butterflies, if you have 2 of the same chromosome, you are male, and if you only have 1, you're female. For other butterflies, they may emerge as gonandromorphs, where exactly half of the individual is split into female, and exactly the other half is split into male. I think we have a photo. So here you can see there's a male and a female half in this butterfly. And these are really rare to find, actually. If you find it, it's really cool. So other insect species don't need males to reproduce at all. The list goes on. For every pest insect species we have, there are many more with positive impacts on us humans, or simply no known impact at all on us humans. We're surrounded by wonderful tiny creatures in our yards, forests, meadows, in our streams, in our lakes. And nearly everywhere we look, we may find an insect living out an ecological drama just beyond our notice, but in close proximity. Whether they inspire you to study them and become the focus of your life work, like me, or if they simply may bug you, invading your home, insects will always be with us right under our noses. Along with that, my prediction is that we will always need entomologists, because at some point in our lives, insects will intrude, and you might want to have ready answers to know what to do to remedy the situation. And no worries, because I will be there on the job. So you're welcome in advance. So thank you, everyone, kindly for your attention today. That's all I have.
So now we'd actually like to open up the floor for people to share their own stories of awe or bother or good or bad experiences or just different kinds of observations about arthropods or bugs or insects or whatever and the impacts that they've had on your lives.
Mark Mayfield, I was, when I saw the video of the insects way up high in the sky, I remember, I think back of all the times I've climbed to prominent mountaintops and seen at the top large masses of ladybugs. So they really do go way up high and just, I don't know, they just find these prominent points and they land on them. It's pretty interesting.
Thank you.
So I was always curious about the camel spider. And so I thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool to see a camel spider. And I'm glad that I saw it on the distant runway in Balad, Iraq. going across the runway, I could see the lights underneath this camel spider, which was at least halfway out there. So I'm kind of glad it was at a distance, because if it was next to me, I think I would have just, like, come out of my skin. But, yes, the world of insects is really, truly amazing. Thank you.
That's a good story. And one thing I want to add to that is if you ever go out at night during the summer and just kind of shine a flashlight on your lawn, you'll see lots of little spider eyes, like, looking back at you, like, reflecting. And anyway, yeah.
One of the videos you showed had all these ants invading, and I didn't hear what you were supposed to do about it or what they were going to do to us or what. I must have missed that part.
Well, it's different for each species of ant. Some of the like the Argentine ant isn't in this area of the country, but other species might be. So it just depends if you have a specific problem in your yard or whatever. I'd be happy to talk to you after the service if you have specific things, yeah.
I live in a third-floor apartment, and I have ants.
Okay.
They deserve a medal, I think.
Collect a couple and bring it to me, and we'll look at it.
Hi, Sybil. I'd never even heard of fire ants until I sat down in a nest of them in Texas. And I can tell you that, and they bite, and they hang on, and they're vicious, and... You know, my friend rushed me into the shower, ripped off all my clothes, put me in the shower, and those ants wouldn't even let go. And when they did let go, they would bite multiple times as they were going down my body. Whoa. It's like, oh, Texas. And their nests, I guess, you know, go miles. They're just incredible. But I've also had the opportunity to be bit by stung by a scorpion in the California desert that was not necessarily the friendly kind. And here in Kansas, got bit by a brown recluse spider. And... also not so great. Anyway, I was a little dismayed by the mosquito song. Are we not supposed to slap them when they're sucking our blood?
It's a personal choice.
Yes, personal choice.
I just to share an experience. I was walking in the woods in Alabama with my son, who was about 9 years old or 10 years old at the time. We came up to a clearing where a butterfly was just sort of doodling around in the air as butterflies do, and a dragonfly, pow, just took him out and flew off with him. It was quite a show.
My contribution to Buddy's master's and PhD degrees in entomology was to provide a blood meal for mosquitoes. So we would go to a place that had a lot of mosquitoes. He would take a test tube, and as the mosquito finished filling up, he'd put the test tube over it and capture it. If you do not slap that mosquito before it draws out all the blood and the poison that it put in to get to through your skin, you will not have any itching. At least I never did. So all you do is you just sit there and watch them fill it up with your blood and let them fly off and don't swat at them.
Now you know.
That is love.
Dedication to your field. Well, would get caterpillars, monarch caterpillars, for classrooms and watch them grow. I felt bad sometimes wondering if, well, we got them through the whole life cycle and released them, but I don't know if that made them weaker or not. So sometimes I felt a little bad, but it was such a good experience and for the kids. And what was kind of really cool, we got to see everything. Sometimes we see them even emerge from the chrysalis. And the caterpillars themselves, the kids could get their ear close, and they could hear them munching. I mean, they got close to the animals. And what I thought, the caterpillars were beautiful, just more beautiful than the butterflies sometimes, just the whole pattern of their bodies. So that was really a fun thing to do as a teacher. And for the kids, always were fascinating. And asked some really good questions about how do they do that in their chrysalis? How does that happen? And I didn't know. I think I knew a little bit now, but I really still don't quite understand how they do it.
Yeah, that's a great story. And it's actually really cool. You know, when they go into that chrysalis, they basically go into a box, liquefy themselves, they become this slurry, and then they completely rearrange their body form. It's kind of incredible. But.
Okay, Rob, do we really have those bugs in our eyelashes that eat the...
Mites, yeah. So mites are more closely related to spiders. So they're a type of arthropod, but they're not an insect. Insects just have 6 legs, and those mites have 8 legs, so...
Yeah. Makes it even better, right?
Yeah. Diane Barker. Well, I have mostly happy experiences, you know, like being in a glade. We call them gallery forests, the ravines between prairies, and being completely covered with monarch butterflies when when they're in their migration and there's just huge amounts of them. You can't walk. They're all over you. And then encountering fireflies mating, a big meadow full of fireflies. It's so much better than fireworks. It's just incredible. And then a sort of disaster with a tick. I am a tularemia survivor. And I didn't realize how sick I was until I got a 103-degree temperature, and I noticed a sort of golf ball-sized lymph node. And anyway, I'm completely cured from that, I think. And then a humorous incident. I came home from a vacation, and there was a praying mantis sitting on my dining room table. I thought, gosh, how did you get in here, and you poor thing, and before I take you out, I'm going to take your picture. And I didn't know how to operate my camera very well, so the flash came on, and that poor praying mantis freaked out. I don't know if you've ever seen when they just, you know, the wings came out and everything, and then I took a nice picture that didn't scare it. So I have 2 pictures of a praying mantis on the dining room table. Thank you.
Oh, wait, we have time for one more, if there's one more.
I'm Dakota. I work a landscaping job, and I'm sure like a lot of people, you know, do gardening work or, you know, stuff like that. But my relationship with insects changed a lot. When I was a kid and a teenager, I was super afraid of them all the time. I would, like, get panic attacks if I saw a spider in another corner of the house, and I would refuse to sleep downstairs or something if I saw a spider down there. And I don't know, I've just been thinking about how the different types of work that I've had to do have really changed my relationship to insects as a whole, and how I don't know, just changing that mindset has really helped me have more peace in my life, but then also be more noticeable with what exists in the world and what I work with.
That's great. Thank you.
All right, so now we're going to do one last contemporary hymn.
1, 2, 3, go.
Biodiversity.
time. Biodiversity makes a strong community. People, plants, and animals in harmony and unity. Biodiversity is nature's university. People, plants, and animals in harmony and unity. Biodiversity.
Thank you.
I leave you now with these parting words from the famous entomologist John Henry Comstock, chief entomologist of the USDA in the 1870s, who said, "All life is linked together in such a way that no part of the chain is unimportant. Frequently, upon the action of some of these minute beings, depends the material success or failure of our great commonwealth."